You're listening to Panel Borders, which is the podcast version of Resonance FM's weekly show about the world of comics. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this, the first podcast of 2009, we have the first of a quartet of shows about four generations of British cartoonists. Later episodes this month will feature my interviews with Peter Doherty, Judge Dredd artist from the early 1990s to the present day, up-and-coming young artist Mark Ellerby, who is currently featured in a group show at Brent Museum, and my interview with Alan Moore and Pat Mills about their favourite cartoonist, the late Ken Reed, who drew classic humour strips such as Roger the Dodger in the 1950s Beano and beyond. This week I'm looking at the work of the beloved British children's illustrator Raymond Briggs, who in the 1970s created some of the most treasured kids' books of the late 20th century, such as The Snowman, Father Christmas, and Fungus the Bogeyman, which were all turned into successful and memorable animated cartoons in the following decade. In the 1980s and 90s, his work started to include biographical elements, including books based on the character and lives of his parents, such as Gentleman Jim and Ethel and Ernest, which allowed him to venture into highly political subjects such as nuclear war in When the Wind Blows, and elsewhere, British foreign policy in The Tin Pot Foreign General and The Old Iron Woman. If many people only know his work from the cartoons, it's entirely possible they don't realise that Raymond Briggs has been drawing his books in comic strip format since the early 70s, and so is one of Britain's finest, but ironically least recognised, comic book creators. This has started to change in recent years, with the last year alone seeing Briggs talk about his work on stage alongside Brian Talbot at Comica at the Institute of Contemporary Arts, and being awarded a Lifetime Achievement Award by the Cartoon Art Trust, while Jonathan Cape reissued Gentleman Jim as one of their classic British graphic novels. At the end of last year, I managed to arrange a phone interview with Raymond, and we talked about his career so far and his plans for the future. First, though, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
It seems a good time as any to talk to you because you were given a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Cartoon Art Trust recently.
Yes, that's right.
Was that for the accumulation of anything in particular? Did they bring up any particular books that you'd published?
Just the whole work in general, I think, because not all of my work is cartoons, of course, but some of it, although it's done as a children's book, is now called graphic novels. It's the currently fashionable term. And it's one or two other things I've done, like The Tin Pot Foreign General and The Old Iron Woman. That is a cartoonish thing. So I come under the umbrella of semi-cartoonist. And the lady who runs it, Anita, said that most people who are offered this award turn it down because it's like a nail in the coffin, you know, and they feel they've come to the end of the road. But in my case, I have come more or less to the end of the road at 74 and three quarters. So I don't mind accepting it. It was a great honour. I was very pleased.
Well, some of the great painters came into their own in their 70s and 80s.
Yes, that's right.
And also this year has seen the republication of Gentleman Jim in a new edition.
Yes.
Was that one of your titles that you felt had been neglected?
No, I didn't think it had been neglected. It did very well as a children's book. I'm surprised they've resurrected it under this new graphic novel thing. But it's beautifully done in Canada as a special edition in Canada and another one by Jonathan Cape here. And so I was very pleased about that because it's about, God knows, 20 or 30 years old, I think.
Mm. And, Gentleman Jim and When the Wind Blows and Ethel and Ernest form a semi-autobiographical trilogy about your parents. I mean, was that something that you'd intended to do for a while when you did Gentleman Jim?
No, I didn't think of my parents at that stage. I've been told by reviewers and critics and editors down the years that my things are very parent-centred. You know, my mother turns up in things, and these, as you say, those three books were a bit like my parents, and of course Ethel and Ernest is about my parents anyway. So I finally came into the open with that one. So many of these other books are like my parents. These ones, I'd better do one about them. So that's how that came to be.
Mm. Although I suppose at that point you had to make the transition between the characters in Gentleman Jim and When the Wind Blows being based on your parents to it being actual autobiography.
Yes.
I mean, with Ethel and Ernest, were there a variety of stories that you'd accumulated within your own life that you felt needed telling by that point?
No, I don't think so. I just went through their life chronologically from when they got married, 1930, I think it was, just picking up the main events that happened and the various little human incidents that happened, me running home from school when I was 5 years old, having only just started at school because I couldn't find the lavatories and so on, ran all the way home to go to the lavatory, and silly things like that, and me telling my father off for washing in the kitchen sink when he could have used the bathroom. But of course they were so enamored of the bathroom and used to look upon it as a shrine almost, because they'd both grown up in houses without a bathroom. So they thought, oh, it's very, very special, very special. Mustn't get it dirty, you know. And that's what the bathroom is for, of course. But there we are.
I mean, I suppose to a lot of people who come across your work for the first time, you're best known for the kids' books you did in the 1970s, things like Father Christmas, Fungus the Bogeyman, and The Snowman.
Mm.
I mean, with Father Christmas, was that the first book of yours that you'd done in a comic strip format? Because I looked at your bibliography, and you'd obviously been illustrating children's books for about 20 years before that already.
Mm. Yes, it was the first in that format, I think. I didn't plan again to do a graphic novel. I don't think we'd even heard of that term then. You are strictly rationed with the number of pages you have in a picture book, usually 32. It's got to be exactly 32 as well, not 31 or 33. It's got to fit exactly, including what they call the prelims. That's the title page and everything.
Mm.
And I found I needed a lot more pictures than 32 because I went into some detail of his home life and everything. And so I was forced into doing whatever it is, 8 or 10 pictures per page instead of one. And so it turned into this kind of strip cartoon thing, which is a terrible labor. I don't really like the medium because it's very labor-intensive, to put it mildly.
Although, I mean, it's now ironically what you've become famous for as a pioneer of, to create a dreaded phrase, comics for all ages.
Yes. Yes, I didn't know I was, and the editor who worked on Gentleman Jim, who now lives in France, wrote to me the other day when he'd seen a copy of it and said, I didn't know in the 60s or 70s, whenever it was we did this, that we'd done a graphic novel. I didn't know I'd produced a graphic novel. We just thought it was another book, you know. But I'm glad the strip cartoon format is coming into a dignified, looked upon as something reasonably dignified and sensible and not just something silly for kids. It looked upon as a major medium on the continent. They have bande dessinée in France, which you go into a bookshop, there's a whole section on it, just as important as theatre, just as important as film. And whereas in England it's been looked down upon in a kind of snobbish way. I've just done a rant for the oldie about snobbery in the arts, you know, with opera at the top.
Mm.
Next rung down is Das Theater, darling. And then right at the very bottom, below even cartoons, is strip cartoon, which is looked upon as the absolute pits. But thankfully, at long last, that is being altered, I hope.
Mm. Well, I mean, it certainly seems over the last year with things like The Guardian pioneering a comic section at the weekends and this new kids' comic, The DFC,
yes,
that people realise that actually it is a good way of getting children into reading.
Well, it certainly is, because a lot of kids are put off by great pages of grey type, But if there's pictures to look at, they find themselves reading the bubbles and things almost without thinking, really. And my snowman book, which is has no words at all, that's even better for little tiddly kids who can't, you know, below reading age, they can follow the pictures and follow a story, and parents or they themselves can make up words to fit, which has been done quite a few times, I think.
Well, I suppose if you're drawing a comic book or a graphic novella, whatever you want to call it, in a way, being able to tell the story without pictures at all must be one of the biggest challenges, and something that shows that you're fairly adept with the art form.
Yes, tell the story without words at all.
Mm.
Yes, it's I suppose it is difficult because it does limit you what you can do. But I felt with that thing, I couldn't see the snowman speaking. And they were having to be very quiet in the house, so there was no point much in the boy speaking either. So it seemed to happen quite naturally there.
When you first did the kids' books in the 1970s, do you remember what your impetus was to do Father Christmas in strip format rather than a traditional children's book?
Well, it was, as I said, this business of not having enough space.
Right.
Nowadays, it seems, with the fact that people can get stuff printed in China, the publishers can get stuff in China done very cheaply. In those days, it was much more strict financially. And we had this business of the 32-page. Occasionally, if you were done something you thought was really important, you might get 40 pages. I think I did once have 48, but they really had an apoplectic fit at doing that. But the situation's altered now because of this cheap printing in China. Brian Talbot has done a book about Alice, Alice in Sunderland, which is 312 pages, I think. Absolutely unbelievable. Full colour on every page.
Yeah.
He should be shot immediately. I told him that when I met him. We did a thing at the ICA, and I said to my editor, who was in the audience, why am I allowed 32 pages and this bloke gets 312?
Well, you know, they say brevity is the soul of wit. So
that's it. Yes, that's a good, I should have said that. That's a good point.
Although I remember, I mean, I went to that talk and you said that you were working on your own magnum opus in black and white about growing old and sort of reflections in later life.
Yes, old age and death. I don't get time to do it now because when you're old, everyday life takes over. You don't seem to have time to get down to any work.
Hmm.
Crazy.
I mean, you come from a fine art background. You studied at the Slade in the 1950s.
Mm.
I mean, what made you decide to go into illustration in the first place rather than, say, fine art?
Well, in those days, you couldn't earn a living in fine art.
Mm.
And I wasn't very good at it anyway. I did do some portraits. I got a couple of portraits into the Royal Society of Portrait Painters and thought, oh, this is it. The commissions from the aristocracy will come rolling in. But they didn't, it's a very different world in those days. There was only about half a dozen galleries in the Bond Street area. That was the fine art world.
Mm.
And nowadays, there's a gallery on every street corner right down in the East End and everything. So you can get somewhere in fine art today, which, in a way which you couldn't possibly then. So I wanted to earn a living, and I had this sort of skill at drawing, and my tutor at the Slade said, you've got this amazing knack of being able to create a fairly realistic scene out of your head. He said, I couldn't do that in a million years. So this was this ability to draw, you know, half a dozen people standing on the street corner talking and a horse going by or something, and I could draw that without too much effort. So that was a peculiar knack, which... with that, you could earn some money.
Mm. Did you still carry around sketchbooks for years after having left formal art training?
No, I've never used a sketchbook much. If you're doing the work professionally or doing it all day anyway, the last thing you want to do when you're in a cafe having a cup of coffee or in a pub is to whip out a book and start drawing. You think, leave that at home. Shirley Hughes, a great illustrator, of course, she's a great sketchbook person. And it's never without it.
Hmm. But it's too much of a busman's holiday for you.
Yes, exactly, yes. Gotta get away.
Were there particular influences on your work that you noticed as you were developing as an artist?
No, I don't think so. People always ask me what artists I admire. Lots of them, of course, but I don't know whether I was influenced by them in what I did. I mean, Tin Pot Foreign General is a bit like Stedman-ish, people said, which it was. I didn't think of him doing it, though. It's just having seen his work and some of that influence must have crept in. But the main people I like are the Netherlandish people, you know, Bruegel and Van Eyck and people like that, rather than the Italians, all these fat babies rolling around and Madonnas with bosoms and soulful eyes. I never went for that much.
I mean, I suppose there is a great British tradition of illustration, people like Arthur Rackham. I mean, I wasn't able to find that many examples of your work pre-1970 on the internet, but the few I find do seem to have that very sort of calligraphic, lithograph quality to them.
Oh, do they?
That's a surprise to you, then.
Not me. I can't remember anything before 1970.
but when it came to the children's books, obviously, that gives you an opportunity to work in colour, to work in pastels, to give them a very sort of a florid palette, but at the same time, a sort of a reality that takes in caricature and sort of British landscapes and all that.
Yes, I suppose it does. I mean, it does did open my mind to things. When one of the first books I was given, I went to the OUP, the Oxford University Press, and met Mabel George, who was the great dragon in those days. Very nice when you got to know her, but she had a fearsome reputation. And I took my stuff in to show her, and she looked through it and made some approving noises, and then she said, "How do you feel about fairies?" Oh, my God. Has it come to this? I've been at Slade and just studying the great artists, and she asked me about fairies. So I sort of forced a smile and said, "Oh, yes, of course. Hans Andersen and Grimm, Brothers Grimm, wonderful, wonderful," and not having read a word of them. And she gave me this book of Cornish fairy stories to do, which was absolutely brilliant and opened my eyes to the fact that fairy stories, nursery rhymes, all that stuff is absolutely meat and drink to the illustrator.
Mm.
You know, there's absolutely wonderful things of witches and goblins and demons, and nursery rhymes themselves are not all innocent Kate Greenaway stuff at all. They're full of greed and lust and cruelty and death. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. It's folk poetry. It's got the unfortunate title of being called nursery rhymes, as though it's all baby stuff. It's not at all. It's very, very grim, a lot of it.
Mm. Well, it's weird how every generation seems to bring up the topic of things that are supposedly suitable and unsuitable for children, when it seems the very best children's literature incorporates elements of danger and death and, you know, the fragility of life.
Mm. Yes, well, when I started in that time, late 50s, we had the dread figure of the librarian looming over us, who was liable to... The editors were always terrified that the libraries would disapprove of a book. Sales in those days depended a lot on libraries. There were 10,000 public libraries in the country. You could guarantee, if you did a reasonable book, that you'd sell 10,000 of it. But if you did anything a little bit risque, they might not touch it. And but that faded off a lot during the 60s, which was a liberating time for everybody, I suppose. The time I did Fungus the Bogeyman, no one would have touched that in the 50s.
Right.
I forget what date that came out. In the 70s. Yes, that was about 20 years later. That's right.
Well, and a subject that you seemed to start exploring in the 60s were great adventurers. You illustrated books on Shackleton and Rickentoff.
Yes. Yes, I was given that to do, and that made a nice change. I hadn't thought of doing that kind of book. Another tutor at Slade said I had a very good response to editorial stimulus, which stuck in my mind. That was a great Linton Lamb. And I do apparently have this thing of responding to what I'm asked to do. A lot of artists, when they're asked to do something, say, "Oh, no, I must do my own thing. I can't be told what to do." But I find... I often have turned things down because I don't want to do them, obviously, but quite often people come up with an idea and you think, gosh, that's jolly good, yeah, I could try that. Like with Shackleton and those motor racing books, I'm not remotely interested in motor racing, but somehow the fact you've been asked to do it, you thought, well, have a go. And then you find you quite enjoy it, really.
Mm. I mean, presumably, as you started to gather a body of work, you were given more freedom in the kind of topics that you're allowed to illustrate. Because thinking of the books that you did in the mid-80s, things like When the Wind Blows and The Tin Pot Foreign General, they're very political, and I'm surprised that even children's books, you're allowed to slip that kind of thing under the radar.
Well, they weren't children's books, those, you see.
Okay.
Not at all, but that's what I got into trouble with. Not me, but I mean booksellers in the shops. Just the Oil Raymond Briggs, yes, bung it in the children's section without looking at it. Then irate customers wrote to the publisher and wrote to me, and but I can't help where people put the books.
The fact that you were dealing with slightly incendiary subjects in the comic book format, in a way, again, you were sort of pioneering those sort of subjects in comics.
Yes, I didn't know I was. I did just what I needed to do. I was so appalled by the whole nuclear thing at the time, and I thought it seemed like a ready-made story, really, that you couldn't not do, and it was a very frightening time. We could have all been obliterated from one day to the next. It was quite extraordinary to think those American planes were in the air 24 hours a day, actually heading towards Russia, and had to wait for a signal to telling them to turn back, otherwise they would go on.
Mm.
Quite astounding state of affairs. Why we weren't all shaking in our shoes night and day, I don't know. And the Tin Pot Foreign General thing, that was again, seemed to me like a ready-made fairy tale again.
Mm.
You had these two despots, as it seemed to me, both incredibly puffed up with their own importance and both fairly fanatical. And again, it was like the giants in a fairy story and the poor chaps being sent off to do their bidding and getting killed. And it was sort of blindingly simple, you know. People have said to me since, are you going to do anything about Iraq, for God's sake? But, I mean, that's an incredibly complex situation, whereas that was dead simple.
Mm.
Incredibly simple.
Well, quite often it seems that if you deal with those sort of subjects in a medium that people aren't prepared, like, for example, science fiction or fantasy or comics, it almost allows an entirely new readership to think about issues that they wouldn't normally approach.
Yes, I suppose that's true. I mean, the Tin Pot General even was in the bestseller list for, I can't remember now, several weeks, which is incredible. You know, in the top 10, a book like that, in the general list, not children's or comics or anything, just the list alongside novels and everything else. So that was absolutely astonishing.
And I suppose you were lucky in a way at the time, because since, I mean, you've seemed somewhat aggrieved that you were pigeonholed as a children's illustrator for years, but at the same time, because your comics were being published in that format, it meant you had much nicer reproduction of your artwork than other comic book artists of the time.
Yes, I suppose that's true. I hadn't thought of that. That's very true. Yes, because comics are bashed off, real comics are bashed off on cheap paper as cheaply as possible, whereas doing things in books with a respectable publisher, you do get a well-done production, which is very good. Yes, that's true.
But for your new project that you're working on, I believe you said that you're going to do it in black and white?
Yes, that's to make life a bit simpler.
Mm.
Colour's very laborious, and I'm not a good natural colourist at all, and you don't have to fiddle us about with paint. I feel at home with a drawing medium. That's why I liked crayon for doing things like the snowman, because you can draw and colour at the same time. And with this, I just want to draw and don't want to get involved with fiddling about with paint. And it's so messy, paint, and it's, unless you're very good at it, putting on washes and getting them off again and stretching paper, it's a terrific fiddle-dee-dee. Whereas if you're drawing, you could just have a flat sheet of paper. You don't even need to stretch it. You could just stick it on the board and draw like you did when you were a student. You know, it's very... You've got to design the book at the same time and do the typography, of course, but that's fairly straightforward when you've been doing it for years.
Mm. Was that something you ever found difficult, working in so many disciplines at the same time, typography and paint and drawing? I mean, you seem to be very versatile as an artist within the medium.
Yes, I don't know. I suppose I got to it gradually. I did all these years of painting at Wimbledon and at Slade, and then went to the Central and did a part-time course in typography and book production, because I found I was doing more and more book work, so I had to learn about typography and the whole thing of book design. Bought the Hugh Williams book on book design and read that dutifully, and got very interested in it, really. And in the first books, I had illustrated for Hamish Hamilton, these little storybooks. I even redesigned them because I couldn't stand the design they sent out. I redid the typography and the title page and all that. But, yes, I find that interesting.
So it must be rewarding that at various stages of your career, like the recent the Comic Arts World Life Achievement Award, and then the various allowance you've been given by publishers to do design, must at least make you feel that you're being recognised by your peers and other artists at different stages.
Yes, a bit of recognition is quite good. I was made a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature a few years ago, and I thought that was very grand respectability again. And so that's the sort of thing that's very nice when your own contemporaries and people in the field approve of you and like what you do. That's the best thing you can have. I mean, Steve Fell the other night, oh, I don't know whether you were there at that comics thing, but he said it was seeing My Father Christmas that turned him on to being a cartoonist and illustrator. He saw this book and liked it and said, oh, that's what I want to do. So I can say truthfully to the world that I gave the world Steve Bell.
Oh, fantastic.
Which is, makes life worth living, after all.
as long as no one mentions that blooming song.
That's right. Oh, dear.
So how is the progress on the new book going?
It's standing dead still at the moment because my partner's not very well. And
thank you very much for talking to us.
No, not at all. A jolly good interview.
It's my pleasure.
You've certainly swatted it up very well. It's more than some of them do.
Well, I have to say I am a comics nerd.
Are you? Probably more than I am, I expect.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks ever so much.
Cheers.
On next week's show, we're moving from a creator who made his mark in the 1970s to one who's just making an impression now. Mark Ellerby is a young cartoonist who self-publishes his own diary comics, has illustrated books for Image Comics and Oni Press, runs the Waterstones Lakeside Manga Club, and is featured in a group show currently on at Brent Museum in Willesden Green. My interview with Mark is on at the same time, 5 p.m. next Thursday, on Resonance 104.4 FM. In the meantime, if you'd like to hear my chat with Raymond Briggs again, it's repeated on Sunday at 11:30 p.m. and will be available online shortly as a podcast that you can stream or download on my blog at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. which also contains links about Raymond's many graphic novellas and books for children. If you're not sick of the sound of my voice, cartoonist Dan Lester and myself are guests on Resonance FM's show about Asian culture, Lucky Cat, which is on Tuesday night at 9 p.m. We'll be talking to presenter Zoe Baxter about the films of Tetsuya Nakashima, such as Memories of Matsuko and Kamikaze Girls. And you can find more info about that at luckykitty.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.